from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we talk with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. With Democrats trying to find their footing after a disappointing November election, many are looking to Sanders as the party's best shot at regaining prominence and to take on President-elect Donald Trump. Sanders looks back on his campaign that challenged Hillary Clinton for the presidential nomination in his new book, Our Revolution. Join us for a conversation with Bernie Sanders on where he thinks the party and the country go from here. That's next on Forum after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Not long ago, Senator Bernie Sanders was an independent from the small state of Vermont with little national profile. But after a strong insurgent campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination against Hillary Clinton, the party is now looking to him to help Democrats regain their footing and hold President-elect Donald Trump accountable. He's been named outreach chair and given the Democrats' top post on the Senate Budget Committee. In his new book titled Our Revolution, Bernie Sanders looks back on his campaign and to the future. He lays out a plan for a new progressive agenda aimed at helping working families and the shrinking middle class. Welcome, Senator Bernie Sanders, and thank you for being here.
I mean, it's great to be with you.
Outreach chair, that position, what does it mean? What's it going to do?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I'll tell you what it really means to me, and we've just begun working on it. It means totally revitalizing and reforming the Democratic Party. It means being honest about where the Democratic Party is today, and that is a party which not only lost the White House against the least popular candidate in the history of this country, but a party which does not control the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House, a party which has lost some 900 legislative seats in House, in state capitals all over the country. And a party in which two-thirds of the governor's chairs are held by Republicans. So I think any objective assessment of where the Democratic Party is says that we need real change. And the real change is that there have been some people who work very hard, whose intentions are very good, and I do not mean to insult them. But essentially, it has been a liberal elite that has been running the party, often people with a lot of money. And I think it's time to understand that what we need to do is build a grassroots party, and that is to open the door of the party to millions and millions of working people, of young people who have ideas, who have energy, who love this country, who want to transform this country, but who in a number of ways, subtle and not so subtle, have been kept out of the Democratic Party.
And that's why you're championing Keith Ellison, the Minnesota congressman, to lead the DNC.
Right. Keith has a long history, A, of being one of the most progressive members of the U.S. House. So on the issues, Keith is now co-chair with Raul Grijalva of the House Progressive Caucus. So on the issues, Keith is there. But second of all, what Keith knows in his heart and in his soul is that we need to create a grassroots party. And I think he will do a great job, and I'm strongly supporting him.
He's also an American Muslim. What role do you think that plays? Or is that part of your calculation?
No, it really wasn't. You see, we can talk about this. I'm not much into identity politics. It goes without saying that the Democratic Party has got to reach out and bring more African Americans, more women, more Latinos, more LGBT community people into the party. That goes without saying. But we can't simply say that just because somebody is X, that's good enough. The heart and soul of the party has got to be candidates, black and white and women and gay, who are prepared to stand up to the billionaire class who today control the economic and political life of this country. So the fact that Keith is a Muslim, I think what's symbolic about this is, especially with Trump's ascendancy, is that there cannot be any compromise on bigotry, on racism, on sexism, on homophobia, on Islamophobia. And the fact that Keith happens to be a Muslim, I think, tells us that the Democratic Party is going to stand with minorities. We're not going to allow a rebirth of racism and discrimination in this country.
But let's talk about identity politics a little bit more, because I think there are a lot of questions and potentially concerns around this, right? As we talk about courting working class voters, white working class voters that the party has lost its connection with, there's concern that it can be presented as to the expense of focusing on a more multicultural agenda, right? That in some ways there's a tension between trying to meet the needs of these voters versus, you know, the platform or the values of the Democratic Party on diversity.
No, I hear that, Mina, but I disagree. It certainly does not have to be. Our goal has got to be twofold. Number one, we need more women in politics. Today, after years of making progress, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think we have about 20 women in the United States Senate. It's a hell of a lot more than the one woman who was there a few years ago, but it is nowhere near enough. So that means we bring more women in. We bring more African Americans in. We bring more Latinos in. We bring more Muslims in. That goes without saying. But on the other hand, is it good enough to say, vote for somebody, he's black? What happens if he is a conservative on all of the important economic issues that affect black working class people? Is it good enough just to say, vote for somebody, he's Asian American? Is that good enough? I think what we need to do is A, diversity, but B, deal with the economic reality of America. And that reality is, which Mr. Trump dealt with, is that for 40 years, the middle class of this country has been in decline. All right? People, whether you're black or you're white or you're Latino, many people are working longer hours for low wages. We have a grotesque level of income and wealth inequality. These are issues that the Democrats for too long have avoided. Are we better off today than we were when Obama first came in? Absolutely. Unemployment is far lower. We're doing better, but not good enough. So it's not just white working class people. It is African-American working class people. It is Latino working class people. They want to be able to send their kids to college. They want health care that they can afford, prescription drugs that they can afford. They are concerned about climate change and transforming our energy system. So I don't think it's an either or to answer your question. I think we go forward aggressively in both areas.
Well, how did Trump win? Was it the economic pain of his voters, or was bigotry involved? And, you know, to what extent, right, can that be... If you're saying we can't go back on bigotry, right, to what extent can we address that he did run a race-baiting campaign?
That was the cornerstone of his campaign. It was bigotry. And let's not forget that before Mr. Trump became a candidate for president, he was the leader of the so-called Bertha movement. And you know what that was. And that was a clear racist effort to undermine the legitimacy of the first African-American president in our history. That's what it was. It was a racist effort. And when he began his campaign, he attacked Latinos, calling Mexicans rapists and criminals. He came up with this brilliant idea that people of one of the largest religions in the world, Islam, should not be able to enter the United States. His attacks against women were so vulgar we can't even use the words that he used right here on the radio. So there is no question that bigotry was the cornerstone of his campaign. But there are some people who think, some liberals who think, well, that's how he won. It was all bigotry. You know, everybody out there who voted for him is a bigot, is a racist, is a sexist. I don't believe that for a second. Was there bigotry? Did some people respond to that? Absolutely. On the other hand, what he also said, and this is really incredible, and this speaks not to his strength, but in my view, to the weakness of the Democratic Party. Here you have this billionaire who has outsourced his manufacturing to Mexico, to Turkey, to Bangladesh. And he goes and he's a multi-billionaire. He doesn't pay any taxes. And he says, I will take on the establishment. Now, how crazy is that? All right. But he got away with it. He got away with it because there was not a counterforce which says, are you kidding? Are you kidding? But here is the truth. People in the middle class, in the working class of this country, are extremely unhappy at the political establishment, at the economic establishment, and at the media establishment. So to answer your question, was racism and bigotry a part of his victory? Yes. Was the fact that so many people out there are working longer hours for low wages, scared to death about the future for their children, can't afford health care, can't afford the medicine they need, can't afford to send their kids to college, and meanwhile seeing almost all new income and wealth going to the top 1%, that a lot of people respond to his so-called anti-establishment message Yes, he talked about trade. Well, you know what? We have lost millions of decent-paying jobs. In the last 15 years, some 60,000 factories in this country have shut down, not all of it due to trade. But you got some corporations out there who, if they can make a nickel more by going to a low-wage country, they'll be gone tomorrow. People understood that. He talked about that issue. So his solutions are not right, but he did talk about that issue. So to answer your question, I think he won because there is a lot of pain in this country, which we don't see on television. We don't see in the halls of Congress. He touched that nerve. That was one of the reasons he won.
We're talking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent in congressional history who challenged Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination. Senator Sanders, we reached out to our listeners ahead of your visit to us here in the studio today, and they sent us several questions. And I want to ask you one from Rebecca, who writes, does the progressive wing of the Democratic Party have to split off from mainstream Democrats? Re-election of Pelosi and resistance to Ellison seem to suggest the Democratic Party is reticent to change or to even be meaningfully reflective about its failures.
Well, let me take the latter part of the question, reflective about its failures. I think that's correct. Look, the party has been controlled by a certain number of people. And I'm not here to put down people. These people have worked very, very hard. And if you compare my views toward them versus our views toward Trump, it's night and day. We are much closer together. But to answer Rebecca's question is they have got to understand they have failed. Their approach has failed. And we need a new line of attack. We need a new approach.
And their approach being, you mean working with big business, focusing on fundraising?
Let's be honest. It was Bill Clinton who gave us NAFTA, which became the precursor to other disastrous trade agreements, which cost us millions of jobs. It was under the Bill Clinton administration. And I got to tell you, I voted for Bill Clinton. I supported Bill Clinton. And I think he did some good things. So I'm not here to, you know, knock Bill Clinton all over the place. But it was under Bill Clinton that you had Robert Rubin, Secretary of Treasury who from Wall Street, who led the effort to deregulate the financial industry, which in my view led us to the 2008 crash. Does that sound like the Democratic Party that we need, a party that gives us unfettered free trade supported by all of corporate America, the pharmaceutical industry, a party that gives Wall Street what they had dreamed of for years, and that is deregulation? So we have to make a choice, and the choice goes back to the old Woody Guthrie song. Remember that song? It says, "Which side are you on?" Remember that song? I don't know if you do, but some of the listeners will. And ultimately, you have to make a choice. Are you on the side of working people? Are you on the side of big money? Democratic Party has got to come down on the side of working people.
Well, Bernie Sanders, Pelosi was challenged from the right, and she is, whether you feel that this is the appropriate label for her or not, seen as, you know, a left coast progressive, you know, part of the progressive wing, more far left than other members of the Democratic Party. There are folks, and she was challenged by Tim Ryan, the Ohio representative, who said, you know, to really get Youngstown folks like he represents, you really need to move to the center. The Dems have to move a little bit.
It's not a question of moving toward the center. That's absolutely wrong. It is a question of having the guts to take on the billionaire class. Now, I know when I say this, a lot of people become uncomfortable. It's not something we talk about terribly much on radio or on television. But here is the reality. And the American people, if they don't know it intellectually, if they haven't read three books about it, they know it in their guts. And what is the reality of America today? The reality of America today is that we are drifting rather rapidly toward an oligarchic form of society. And what that means is you're seeing a handful of multi-billionaire families controlling our economy and controlling the political life of this country. So the issue is, do we have the guts to take those people on? It's not a question of drift going to the center. The American people understand that. For example, on every important issue facing the American people, and I want the listeners to see this as something very hopeful, on every major issue facing the American people, the average American is supportive of the progressive agenda. All right, let me rattle them off. Raising the minimum wage, overwhelming support for raising the minimum wage, and I want to congratulate California, New York State, Seattle, and so forth for helping to lead the effort. $15 an hour. Pay equity for women. overwhelming support. Rebuilding our infrastructure, creating millions of decent-paying jobs. Dealing with campaign finance reform. Whether you are a Republican listening to this program or a progressive Democrat, you know what? You think the system is pretty corrupt when you got a handful of billionaires who can put hundreds of millions of dollars into the system. Dealing with climate change. Well, I'm not going to tell you everybody in America thinks that we should. Most people do. Most people do think we should invest in sustainable energy and energy efficiency. Making public colleges and universities tuition-free. Expanding Social Security. On all of those issues and many more. You don't move to the right. You don't move to the center. Those are the issues that bring people together. But people want to know that the Democratic Party has the guts to stand up to powerful forces who do not want those changes.
We're talking with Bernie Sanders, the Vermont senator who shook up the country and the Democratic Party with his insurgent bid to defeat Hillary Clinton for the presidential Democratic nomination. We want to let our listeners know that we're streaming this interview on Forum's Facebook page, so you can watch as well as listen to this interview live. Senator Sanders, I want to talk with you about your response to the deal, quote, deal that Donald Trump announced yesterday with Carrier Corporation. You wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post where you took him to task and you said that Trump has essentially signaled to every corporation in America that they can threaten to offshore jobs in exchange for business-friendly tax benefits and incentives. It was a strong and provocative column that actually got a lot of play. I mean, you just Google Carrier or turn on the news and your critique was right up there. Michelle writes, feeling discouraged and fearful after the election. Senator Sanders has been on the front lines through times like these. Are we going to be okay? I'm wondering, is this part of the strategy?
Yes, it is. It's one part of a strategy that says, you know what, Mr. Trump, you may think you can change your mind every day. You may think you can lie all the time. You may think that politics is show business. But you know what? We are going to hold you accountable. Now, during his campaign, roughly speaking, what Mr. Trump said, he said, outsourcing has been extraordinarily destructive to working people in this country. He's right. In the last 15 years, we have lost, as I mentioned before, 60,000 factories, millions of decent-paying jobs, not all of it due to trade. Automation has an impact, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of it from corporations, as United Technologies has done in Indiana, who are very profitable and yet simply are shutting down because they can make more money, in this case, going to Mexico. Now, what Trump said is the solution is to stand up to this corporate greed, and the solution is to slap a 35% tariff on companies like Carrier, which is owned by United Technologies, so that if they want to go and build furnaces in Mexico, pay people there $3 an hour, they're going to have to pay a heavy tariff for those products to come back into this country. I think that is one aspect of a solution. I think another solution is to understand that United Technologies, which, by the way, 2 years ago paid its former CEO $172 million in a golden parachute, which made $7 billion profit last year. I think the other thing you say to these guys is, you know what? You're not going to ship jobs abroad. You're not going to lower the standard of living of American workers and then expect to get defense contracts. We're going to be looking at that as one of the criteria to determine whether or not you get government contracts. What Trump ended up doing is going back on everything he said during the campaign, and his solution to the problem was to get the state of Indiana to provide a $7 million tax break for half of the workers. Half of the jobs are going to be lost. They're going to go to Mexico. Half of the workers, and they're going to be that Carrier, which made $7 billion in profits last year, United Technologies made $7 billion, is going to get a $7 million tax break from the people of Indiana. Now, the problem there is you got corporations who maybe never thought about leaving the United States. And they're sitting there and saying, hey, all I got to do is say, hey, I'm going to Vietnam tomorrow. I want a tax break to keep me here. So it is a very bad policy in terms of dealing with the problems of outsourcing.
How much should Democrats work with Trump? What are the criteria that you use to determine whether or not you work with him?
There are some areas where there cannot be any compromise at all. And we have got to develop strategies to fight this thing to the end. And that is the issues of bigotry. That's number one. You know, since Trump was elected, and even before, you know, we think back about American history. And we think about the struggles of so many extraordinarily brave people who put their lives on the line and sometimes died to fight against bigotry, going back to even before this country was a country in terms of what the settlers did to the Native Americans, the atrocities committed against the Native Americans. Then we have the abomination of slavery and all of that. And then we have the sexism where 100 years ago today, women couldn't vote. They weren't running for president. They were unable to vote. They couldn't get the jobs, the education, the homophobia that existed, the discrimination against the Irish, the Italians, the Jews. We have struggled as a nation to try to overcome that, and we cannot give Mr. Trump one inch in terms of taking us backwards. So that's one area, no compromise. Second area where I think we cannot compromise is, despite Mr. Trump's assertion during the campaign, climate change is not a hoax. Climate change is one of the great environmental crises that this planet faces. And if we don't get our act together and transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, the future of this planet is at stake. So how do you compromise on that? How do you say, oh, great idea, Mr. Trump. Let's become more dependent on fossil fuel. Let's destroy this planet for our kids and our grandchildren. I don't think you can compromise on that. And another area where that cannot be compromised is what I worry about very much. You will recall just a few days ago, Mr. Trump sent out a tweet. I guess we're going to be governed by tweet here. He sent out a tweet saying that he would have won the popular vote, which Clinton, of course, won by 2 million votes, if millions of people had not voted illegally. That is totally delusional. It's totally insane. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes that. And what that really tells me is that he wants to accelerate the effort toward voter suppression. Okay, so he's sending a signal to governors all over this country, you go ahead, you make it harder for people who might vote against us to participate. And then add that to the fact that for some Republican leaders, they think Citizens United did not go far enough. They want to end all campaign finance limitations so that billionaires could buy candidates directly. So add those things together, I worry about the future of democracy. So those are the areas where I don't think we can compromise. We're not going to compromise on bigotry, discrimination, or climate change, or democracy. But where I think if he comes up with a reasonable idea to rebuild our infrastructure and create millions of jobs, do I think we should work with him? Yes, I do.
We're talking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent in Congress who challenged Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination and inspired millions on a platform of economic reform. He won over young people overwhelmingly and 13 million votes during the primary. He's now in a position of enormous influence among Democrats who hope that he can help them regain their footing. Join the conversation with your questions or comments for Bernie Sanders. Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim. More with Bernie Sanders after the break. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. A struggling Democratic Party is now looking to Sanders to play a key role in helping the party regain its prominence and hold President-elect Donald Trump accountable. Sanders has a new book. It's called Our Revolution, where he looks back on his presidential bid for the Democratic presidential nomination and also lays out a plan for a new progressive agenda. To join the conversation, the number again is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. And also, you can watch and listen to today's program. We are on Forum's Facebook page airing this interview live. Benjamin writes, Bernie, my mom and I think you are the best. If I could have voted, I would have voted for you. And Benjamin is 10 years old. So much of what, in reading Our Revolution, I feel like so much of what has formed the views that you hold today about the working class, about poverty, comes from your background in a rent-controlled apartment in Brooklyn, where you literally slept on the couch frequently because there was not a bedroom for you. How much did that experience shape your perspectives today?
Well, I mean, it shaped it a lot. It's still with me today. And it will always be with me. You know, we did not grow up in a poor home where we didn't have enough food to eat. But we grew up in a house where there just was not enough money to do the things that my mom, you know, wanted us to do. We lived in a small rent-controlled apartment. Her dream was that someday maybe she would own a home of her own, and that never happened. And when you grow up in a family where money is scarce, there's always a level of tension, always fights, and sometimes bitter fights between my parents, things that which a kid, you know, does not forget. And the truth is that experience is the experience of many millions of people all over this country today, right? People listening to the show, and they're figuring out, how am I going to pay the electric bill? Okay, how am I going to afford to get the money I need to put gas in the car to get to work? Because if I don't get to work, then, you know, I'm going to lose my job. I lose my job. How do I take care of my kids? So that growing up in a working class community with a family that did not have a lot of money certainly played a major role in shaping my politics. No question about that.
And the other thing quickly before I take calls is how much you talked about your love of the Brooklyn Dodgers, because yes, your experiences growing up right in Brooklyn shaped your views on how hard it is, right, that existence. Yeah. But it was the Brooklyn Dodgers that sounded like they shaped your democratic values, both on issues of race and on capitalism. Well,
you know, the point that I was made as a kid, and, you know, I think back on this, we, unlike kids today, and I'm not sure this is a good thing. Kids today are supervised. You go to Little League, right? You have 14 coaches and everyone's telling you what to do. We went out on the street. So all the kids went out on the street. We had an hour after hour playing all kinds of games. And, you know, we developed the games. We chose up the teams. We determined who was safe and who was out. We determined, you know, where we would play. And it was, in many ways, a democratic, very democratic approach. Nobody could argue you were the best ball player. He was second. He was third best basketball player. Everybody knew it. Okay. And that was a very interesting process. The Dodgers, when you grow up as a kid, as I did, I was born in 41, in Brooklyn, it was, you did not know that it was a privately owned entity. It was Brooklyn Dodgers, the Brooklyn Bridge, Brooklyn College. It was Brooklyn.
Everybody.
How do you, you know, and then suddenly that somebody could take away what was at the heart and soul in many ways of that community, of that borough, of that city, was astounding to me.
And move it to Los Angeles.
Right. There was a joke that went around those days, and it said that the three most hated people of the 20th century were Stalin, Hitler, and Walter O'Malley, not necessarily in that order. O'Malley was the guy who owned the Dodgers and took them to California. But, you know, in terms of race things, what it was is we weren't great, quote-unquote, liberals. We knew every ball player on the team. Jackie Robinson became a – Roy Campanella, Don Newcomb. Yeah, they were black, so what? Who cared? Newcomb was a great pitcher. Campanella was a great catcher. Robinson was a great second baseman. They were great ball players. Who cared what color they were? All right, that was the important thing. They were part of the Brooklyn family. And when that team was simply yanked out so this guy could make more money going to California, with all due respect to the great state of California, it did. It left an impression on me.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say. David in San Francisco, you're on with Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, I met you in 2012 with the late gay labor activist Howard Wallace, and I was very impressed with you then. The questions I have is, what can we do about the Electoral College? Clinton is leading by 2.5 million votes. It may turn out to be three. This is a complete joke. It's unprecedented even in American history. And what about other candidates, basically? Candidates like Elizabeth Warren, potential candidates like Ron Reagan. And also, can we filibuster Trump's nominations in the Senate? Can we actually defeat some of these things, even though we don't have a majority?
David, thanks.
David, three good questions. Question number one, the Electoral College. I think David is exactly right. It's very hard to say to somebody, oh, Clinton got 2.5 million more votes than Trump, and Trump is going to be inaugurated president. Duh. Something is missing in that picture.
But do you think it needs to be done away with, as some have proposed?
We need to have a serious discussion. But the fact that somebody wins the popular vote by 2.5 million votes and is not inaugurated is a little bit crazy to my mind. And the second part of it, maybe as somebody who is a U.S. senator who's involved in politics, I see more than other people, is How many of the major candidates came to California, the largest state in the country, to campaign? Clinton here, Trump here? No, because everybody knew California would go Democratic. They didn't come to Vermont. They didn't go to Wyoming. That was a Republican state. They didn't go to South Dakota, Republican state. They didn't go to Mississippi. So in other words, interestingly enough, the entire campaign came down to 16 or 17 states, so-called battleground states. Well, you know what? We got 50 states in this country. So the issues of California or the issues of Vermont or the issues of Wyoming or the issues of Mississippi did not get a whole lot of hearing because those states were going to be Democratic or Republican. I think that's a little bit crazy, too. So to answer David's question, yes, no question in my mind that we need to rethink a process by which somebody wins an election by 2.5 million votes and is not inaugurated president. Second issue, talks about candidates. And here is maybe, let me take it a little bit approach differently than David. There are great candidates out there. Elizabeth Warren is extraordinary, a good friend of mine doing a great job in the U.S. Senate. But let's not think about candidates. At the end of my book, I don't know if you got there yet, Mina, there's a whole chapter on corporate media.
Yes, I did.
And the title of the chapter is Corporate Media and the Threat to Our Democracy. All right. Being that corporate media kind of frames the issues. And one of the issues they always frame is candidates. Hey, Mina, are you going to run for president? You're young enough, maybe not in 2020. What do you think, in 2024? Let's do a poll. How many people think Mina could be a good president in 2024? It goes on and on and on. That's not the issue. The issue is, why is the middle class disappearing in America? Why do we have so much income and wealth inequality? Why are we the only major country not to have health care or paid family and medical leave? Why don't we talk about that? And as we discuss those issues, you know what? Great leaders will arise. So what media does is focus on personality because it's easier to say, well, Mina's a great candidate or she's a terrible candidate or something happened to her 20 years ago. Let's talk about it. Instead of talking about the real issues facing this country. So to answer David's question, there are great candidates out there. And I'm not worried about that. What I am worried about is involving people in the political process today in a way that we have not seen before. So in the last part of his question, essentially, how do we stop Trump on some of his very bad ideas? And that has to do with an inside-outside strategy. And the inside strategy is Democrats in Congress have got to do everything that they can in opposition. But part of that effort has got to be, and that's kind of why I accepted this position as chair of the outreach effort, is to rally millions of people to stand up against very bad ideas, to get people, young people, working people involved in the political process, to mobilize people around the issues of racism and sexism and economic justice and environmental justice. We can do it. We can do it.
Who are you most concerned with in terms of his cabinet appointments, which was one of the things that David raised? I mean, Mnuchin, for example, he wants to cut taxes on the wealthy, cut taxes on corporations, everything. He even wants to talk about stripping back the Dodd-Frank Act. I mean, these are all things that you must find anathema, yeah, right?
The question that we can go on for many, many
but
hours.
But you don't have the Senate votes. And
all right. But here's what we have got to do. And again, here is the point, to go back to a point, the question you asked me a few minutes ago. This is the hypocrisy of Donald Trump. Donald Trump campaigns, as you recall, I, Donald Trump, will take on the establishment. Wall Street, Hillary Clinton is a tool of Wall Street. Oh, yes. Well, I am going to nominate as our Secretary of Treasury somebody who spent his life on Wall Street, who wants to push forward Wall Street's agenda. How hypocritical can you be? Donald Trump says, and we are going to hold him accountable on all of these issues and rally the American people. Trump says during the course of the campaign, I, Donald Trump, am the only Republican candidate who says I will not cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Well, he appoints Congressman Price to be chairman of Health and Human Services. And you know what Price's main goal in life is to cut Medicare or perhaps to privatize Medicare. So we are going to mobilize the American people around opposition to this hypocrisy.
So the focus being on whether his pledge is not to cut Medicare, Social Security.
Look, if you're a
Glass-Steagall,
if you're a worker out there who is sick and tired of establishment politics, you always vote Democratic, but you hear this guy Republican come along and says, I'm not going to cut Social Security. You know, I'm going to reestablish Glass-Steagall. Wow, that's okay. Well, maybe I can vote for this guy Trump. And then the day after the election, suddenly he tells you everything that he said during the campaign was just nonsense. He didn't believe it. Well, yeah, we're going to make the American people aware of that.
Al in Oakland. Hi, Al.
Hi. My response a little bit to Bernie Sanders is a response to any number of people is, why didn't you get out much earlier in the race? And we're talking about, you just talked about Wall Street. Well, you mentioned Wall Street with Hillary over and over and over again. And some people really do hold you partly responsible for the election of Donald Trump. Should have gotten out much earlier. Wondering what your response is.
Al, thanks for the question.
Well, needless to say, I don't agree. I campaigned as hard as I could for Hillary Clinton. And what I managed to do at the end of the Democratic primary process, in which I endorsed her, in which is to urge her to take stronger positions on health care and on higher education, so that we ended up writing together, the Clinton campaign and our campaign ended up writing together the strongest Democratic platform in the history of the Democratic Party and, in fact, in the history of this country. And, in fact, I think our campaign, which brought millions of young people and others into the political process, strengthened Clinton's ability to go forward.
Let me read you a couple of other questions related to the campaign. Carol writes, why did you do nothing to rein in your Bernie bullies and Bernie bros? They were really vile, vitriol. You lost my vote when you did not really get rid of them.
The answer is, of course, we did what we could do. And the answer is, when you have millions of people who support you, and somebody should check out some of the Clinton people's attacks against us. So I don't want to relive the campaign. The goal is now how we go forward. Did we have some people in our campaign who were vile? Yes. Were there some people in Clinton's campaign? By the way, if you go to the WikiLeaks, I mean, you will find that there were, as I recall, hundreds of pages of opposition research on Bernie Sanders, some of which was used in a very ugly way.
Speaking of those leaks, some have wondered here, why didn't you ask us to fight the corrupt DNC and keep you in? I think we all gave up too early.
Well,
Monica.
So we're getting questions from very different. Why don't I do this? Why don't you do that? Look, at the end of the day, you know, we took on the entire Democratic establishment. And the book talks about that. We ended up not having the support of one governor, Democratic governor in America. We had one United States senator, Jeff Merkley of Oregon, handful of congresspeople. And yet we ended up with 46% of the popular vote. Almost no superdelegates, because all the superdelegates, so many of them came on board Clinton's campaign, even before there was any opposition. But at the end of the day, you know, Clinton got more votes than we did. And I felt it appropriate to go on from there and not, you know, bring turmoil. But I think what is clear from a lot of evidence is the DNC under Debbie Wasserman Schultz was not, quote unquote, objective. They were not impartial, that the deck was stacked in favor of Clinton. I think that's indisputable. But so what? The point is, we are where we are today, and I don't see much good in rehashing the campaign. We got to go forward. We have some enormous problems facing this country. We've got to revitalize the Democratic Party.
Well, a listener tweets, what does Bernie Sanders think of the ballot recount effort by Jill Stein? Do you have any opinions on that?
Well, you know, she has every right in the world to do that. I think where the interest has come is there's a lot of concern about cybersecurity. And is it possible for ballots, machines to be hacked and election results to be distorted? And I think that's where the interest is. My own guess is that, and I could be wrong on this, but my own guess is that the recount will show that the results turned out to be what they were on election night, that Clinton lost those states. But I think certainly the Green Party has every right in the world to ask for it.
Let's hear from Dan in San Jose. Hi, Dan.
Good day. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One thing that you haven't addressed yet, Mr. Sanders, and by the way, thank you for your participation in the election. Really appreciate it. Is that Donald Trump's personality is, in my opinion, erratic and dangerous. I really appreciate how you focus a lot on the system and how the system has problems. I haven't heard you talk much about personalities, and that's probably one of the main points of your message. we got a guy in power who's erratic, irresponsible, doesn't seem to understand stuff or care. Now, I would like to hear your opinion on that.
Well, Dan, I wish I could tell you that you're wrong and that I strongly disagree with you, but I don't. It is, you know, the problem with Trump is we cease to be stunned by anything that happens. If Trump announces tomorrow that he has a good friend who he's been talking to who lives on the moon, people say, well, that's interesting. That's just another statement. You know, there's nothing that is any more anything outrageous. As I just mentioned, just the other day, I mean, 2 days ago, 3 days ago, he said that he would have won the popular vote, but millions of people voted illegally. That is a lie. I mean, just and I think in many ways, this guy is a pathological liar. I think he is not particularly interested in policy. He was talking the other day that one of the criteria for him selecting important nominees for major agencies is how they appeared on television. You know, how well they came across on TV. So I what can I tell you? I agree with Dan, and I think that just speaks even more to the need for the American people in an unprecedented way. Look, let's be clear. These are dangerous ways, and millions of people are going to have to rethink their commitment to the political process in whatever way. So what I would say to Dan is you're right. But the antidote to that is right. That millions of people have got to come together and say, Mr. Trump, we don't care what your views are on climate change. We are together. We've got to figure out a way to transform our energy system, et cetera.
Millions of people have to come together. You stress that. Does the Democratic Party also have to be more brazen? You know, there's an example of a tweet, whether you sent it or not, to a science committee in the House that shared a Breitbart article that claimed the Earth was cooling. And the tweet from your account said, "Where'd you get your PhD? Trump University?" Is that the kind of way to fight that kind of language?
In many ways, the answer is we fight. How do you fight back? And you fight back in many, many ways. But I think essentially the most effective long-term, although difficult, approach is through grassroots organizing. That's the way you do it, that you mobilize millions of people to stand together around issues. For media, somebody said something very clever on CNN today. Boy, that was a good soundbite. That's fine. Good. We use media. Use media when we can. But at the end of the day, why would anybody in America who works for a living vote or support a candidate for president who wants to give tax breaks to billionaires and then cut programs that the middle class and working class desperately need? And we have to rally people around issues and approaches like that.
Marcus in San Francisco. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Bernie, I was on a lighter note. I was wondering, what organizations should we look to donate to this holiday season? I support an open internet, and I plan to donate to the EFF, but also the Southern Poverty Law Center and ACLU. I was wondering what your opinions were.
Well, those are good organizations. I mean, I think especially with Trump becoming president, supporting groups who will in every way fight bigotry. Is something that I think makes a lot of sense. I think supporting environmental groups who are prepared to be bold. A fellow Vermont neighbor of mine, Bill McKibben, helped found 350.org, which is an international climate change organization. I think we have to be very aggressive in that area. I think working with economic and social justice organizations. But I think now is the time for boldness and to develop strategies which bring our people together.
How do folks raise the money that they need in order to combat virtually unlimited sums of money from their opponents at this point? As you touched upon just how much, right?
You're talking about a very, very, very serious issue. And again, I have a chapter in there which calls it's entitled Defeating Oligarchy. And in it, what I talk about is my great fear that when we move to a campaign finance system, which the Koch brothers and other billionaires want, you know what they say? They want to get rid of all campaign finance limitations. Citizens United did not go far enough. What that means, Koch brothers can come up to somebody and say, I'm going to give you, you want to run for governor of California? I'm going to give you a check for $500 million. I'm giving it directly to you. I am appointing your campaign manager, your speechwriter, your media consultant. Essentially, you are my employee. That is where we are moving. You tie that in, combine that with voter suppression, that is a real threat to American democracy. Now, the answer is obvious that you got to overturn Citizens United. The answer is obvious, in my view, that you got to move toward public funding of elections, that you got to make it easier. And California has done that. Make it easier for people to participate. If you're 18 years of age, you should be able to vote. End of discussion. Vermont has moved in that direction. A number of states have. So the effort now is to move toward public funding of elections where we can. And the goal is to fight voter suppression in every way possible.
And I think you're addressing Bart's question, which was, as one of the loudest voices in campaign finance reform, how do you suggest we move forward with this?
Well, I think what we can do is obviously we have to fight the fight in Congress. But and the Republicans, needless to say, love the current system and they want to make it even worse. They want billionaires to be able to buy elections and they want voter suppression. Our job is in those states where we have power to move forward. New York City, for example, among others, has a pretty good system. You want to run for mayor of New York City and you want to get small donations, it will be matched by public funding.
And the average donation during your campaign was what,
$27? $27, right.
Stephanie in San Francisco, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm really concerned about the judicial branch of our government. I think it's a major threat to democracy, the fact that we are existing with only 8 Supreme Court judges, that the Senate has not held a hearing for Merrick Garland. And I'm just wondering what can be done either now or after the inauguration to make sure that we maintain a third branch of our government that's apolitical.
Well, Stephanie, I think you have every reason to be concerned about that. And this is, you know, you used the word brazen a moment ago, and we have to acknowledge the Republicans have been incredibly brazen. What they said is in violation of very clear language in the Constitution. The President of the United States has the right to nominate individuals to the Supreme Court, and that nomination goes to the Senate for hearings. And what Republicans said, so long as Obama is president, we're not going to hold those hearings. We don't care. Maybe a Republican will be elected. I mean, which is totally outrageous. And I think to answer Stephanie's question, the concern is very legitimate, not only for the Supreme Court, mostly for the Supreme Court, but for many lower courts as well. And I think the Democrats are going to have to figure out a strategy as best we can in the minority to make sure that those people appointed to the Supreme Court and other courts are not extreme right-wing people.
And Senator Dianne Feinstein of California is a ranking member on that judicial committee. Bonnie asks, and Sam, these are two questions about Standing Rock. Bonnie asks, how do we stop the violence in South Dakota? And Sam asks, please ask Bernie if he intends to visit the protest in Standing Rock.
I think you stop the violence by having the governor there and hopefully the president of the United States making it clear that people have the right to protest. This is an issue that is of, I think, concern not only to me, but the concern to millions of people in this country, and that is sovereign Native American sovereign rights are being trampled on. You got the issue of water and whether or not a pipeline should go through an area which supplies water for millions of people. And then you got the whole issue of climate change and whether or not you need another major pipeline when we should be transforming our energy system. So we have done our best up to this point to speak out on this issue, to demand the president be more forceful than he has been. As to whether or not a visit, it's a really a scheduling issue. But I have a lot of respect for and many friends who have been to Standing Rock and support their efforts very much.
Well, Becca writes, the Democratic Party is too entrenched in the status quo. Why not use the Our Revolution platform to start a new progressive or labor party? The two-party system does not seem to work anymore.
It's not a question. I mean, that's look, you're talking to the longest-serving independent in the history of the United States Congress. I have defeated, when I became mayor of Burlington, Vermont, I defeated a five-term Democrat, run against Democrats, run against Republicans. So, you know, I know a little bit about that issue. And people can have honest disagreements. But I think there's nothing magical about the word Democratic Party or Green Party or anything else, nothing magical about the word. The issue is where we are right now and where do we go? It is factually very, very difficult in the structure of American politics to organize a 50-state third party. That's just a fact. At this moment, again, I speak as the longest-serving independent in the history of the Congress, my belief now is that we need fundamental reform of the Democratic Party. That's the easier and quicker approach. And I would urge all progressives to start getting involved. Start getting involved in the Democratic Party. Fight for a progressive agenda. Fight for progressive candidates and hold those people accountable.
Paul writes, thank you, Bernie. You are a beacon of hope. Another listener writes, I want to thank him for being the true champion of the American people and a senator that does his job. I sense, Senator, that you are ready to move on. But I think there are a lot of people who are still looking for hope, that are still processing the election. What are your final words to them in this last 30 seconds that we have?
Okay. I hope people take a hard look at American history and some of the terrible, terrible things that have happened, the struggles that workers had to engage in, that the African-American community, that women, that the gay community had to engage in. All right, we are in a moment where millions of people have to stand up and fight back. It just does not do us any good. Look, needless to say, the past election concerned me very much. But, you know, I was involved in it. But we got to go forward, not back. Let's mobilize our people around the progressive agenda.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
His book is Our Revolution. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.